Welcome to Books Plus. I'm Kate Evans, taking you into Shylock's repurposed world with writer Howard Jacobson and into the troubles in Ireland with Adrian McKinty's cop hero, Sean Duffy. He's back and he's angry. But we'll begin with a writer whose childhood was peopled with famous artists and whose mother was both a muse and inspiration for characters in fiction. She was doing extraordinary things during the Second World War.
Outside the barracks, by the corner lights, I'll always stand and wait for you at night. We will create a world for two. I'll wait for you the whole night through. For you, Lily Marlene.
Writer and curator Anthony Penrose is the son of American photographer Lee Miller and surrealist artist Roland Penrose. They knew everyone, and as a child he met many of the big names in the arts, from Miro to Picasso. He spoke about his life and work in a wide-ranging interview with Sarah Kanofsky, and here's just one part of it, in which he describes the wartime experiences of his photographer mother.
With me, Lily Marlene.
To begin with, she became a photographer for Vogue, a freelance photographer for Vogue Studios in London, shooting fashion and all that kind of stuff. And then little by little by little, she raised her game to photograph the women at war in England, you know, the amazing women of the Royal Navy and the Air Force and all of that kind of person. And then when the Normandy landings came, she was ashore in France very soon after the Allied landings. And she just followed the American troops right through for the rest of the war. And she became a combat photographer, which was probably the only woman combat photographer with the infantry in the war.
It's extraordinary. And she was there at a number of key events during the Second World War, including the liberation of the concentration camp Dachau.
Yes. Well, by this time, she had been fighting her way across Europe for about a year. And even then, nothing could prepare her for the horrors that she found in the camps that she saw liberated. There were four of them in all, and the last two were the most horrific, Buchenwald and Dachau. And, of course, it was even more unimaginably horrible for her, traumatic, because so many of her friends had been found to be missing from Paris when she got through there, most of her Jewish friends, but also anybody who was an artist, a printer, a journalist, anybody that the Nazis had disapproved of was just gone. And of course she was knowing that they were somewhere in this mass of bodies in this camp, you know, and looking for them. That's why she shot so much in close-up. I think she was just searching the faces all the time.
And there's an extraordinary story, Anthony, that on the day that your mother was there at the liberation of Dachau and took some very moving photographs of prisoners, that same day she went with some American GIs to Munich, where they discovered Hitler's apartment. And from that day, there is a remarkable photograph of your mum, Lee Miller, in Hitler's bathtub.
That's right. It is an amazing, incongruous, unbelievable photograph. She was with her wartime buddy, David E. Sherman. He was a Life magazine photographer. And together, thanks to the U.S. Army Signals Corps, they were tipped off where Hitler's house was. And they showed up, and the signalers let them in. And so they were the only journalists there.
Incredible.
And there were just about four other signals guys who were using all the telephone lines and stuff. And suddenly they, you know, I said to Sherman, what do you mean getting into Hitler's tub? I mean, that must have been an appalling thing to do, you know, to get naked in his bathroom and get into his tub. And he said, you know what? We hadn't had our clothes off in 3 weeks. We stank like a bunch of polecats, and there was hot water, soap, and a towel, and we just went in. And then, he said, they realized they had the scoop. And so he photographed Lee.
And it's such, as you say, such an incongruous image, in that she's there in the bath, you know, you just see her head and shoulders, she's soaping herself, she's a beautiful woman. And in this pristine bathtub, there's a photograph of Hitler in full military uniform propped up against the back of the wall. But then at the forefront of the picture, in front of the tub, are your mum's, I imagine, they're hers, very filthy, huge, heavy army boots. So there's so much happening in this image. It really is incredibly striking. Right.
Yes, that photograph is absolutely packed. You see, the photograph of Hitler is by Heinrich Hoffmann, and the reason it's there is it's the most perfectly calculated snub to the Nazis, because that image became the kind of Nazi icon, the sort of holy, sacred image of the Nazi party, and it was on all their posters and everything. And so to take it and put it on the edge of the tub, that was a wonderful snub. But as you've already mentioned, it's the boots. It's the boots that are really significant, because the morning of that day, those boots had carried her around Dachau. Now she's stamping the filth of that place onto Hitler's nice, clean bath mat.
And that was indeed the same day that over in Berlin, Hitler killed himself. I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up, Anthony. It's quite an extraordinary collection of events.
In that photograph, you can almost hear the circles closing. You know, the circles of the world history, of Lee's history, of the moral history of the time and so on. It's just the most incredible axiomatic image.
What kind of impact do you think, Anthony, that this war experience, photographing these horrendous places, these death camps, what sort of impact did that have on your mum after the war?
Well, up to that moment in Hitler's tub, I think the impact had been really extreme. Really traumatic. And then after it got worse, because she went way off into Eastern Europe and she found children, babies dying in hospital because the black market people had stolen all the drugs. She found endless columns of refugees. She found people who were destitute and homeless. And the beautiful, brave new world that was supposed to be delivered at the end of the war just hadn't showed up. And there was this dreadful sense of disillusionment. And that contributed, I think, really to the most difficult time in her life, which was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and suffering the crushing sense of that it had all been for nothing, the disillusionment. And it hit her very badly. And, you know, my dear old dad, he welcomed her home, but he hadn't got a clue how to respond to the awful turmoil that must have been in her mind at that time. I mean, today we know quite a lot about how to treat post-traumatic stress disorder, but in those days there wasn't any understanding, and all you did was you put up and you shut up and you drank a lot of whiskey. And it was not surprising she went into a very steep downward spiral of depression and alcohol abuse.
Were you aware of her career as a war photographer when you were a child?
No, not at all. I mean, occasionally it was mentioned, but she was so disparaging about it. She'd say, oh, yeah, I did a bit, but it was all destroyed in the war and it wasn't important anyway. And what none of us knew, not even my father knew, was the, you know, the incredible achievement and the stuff that she had done was unbelievable. And he also was unaware that she had systematically hidden her entire output way back from the Paris studio with Man Ray right through to the end of the war. She'd hidden all of that in the attic of the old farmhouse.
Wow.
And that's where we found it after she'd died.
Wow. So it was after she died that you found that stash. And did that change the sense you had of your mum?
It changed everything for me and for my dad as well, because when I saw the material, I was blown out. I thought, this can't be Lee's. This can't be the work of the person I knew as a useless drunk. And then, of course, I had to admit that, yes, it was hers. And there was a whole lot of it. And I was invited by Thames and Hudson to write her biography. And in so doing, I had to go and research and talk to people who knew her, and I travelled all over America and Europe and so on. And I remember one occasion I came back from America where I had gotten some very, very poignant information about just how incredibly brave she'd been and more besides. And I was telling all this to my dad, and I suddenly realized that he was getting teared up. He was really emotional. And I thought this was quite a shock to me, because he was not an emotional sort of guy. And I stopped and he said, if only we had known, we could have understood her more, we could have done more for her. You know, we wouldn't have had to have stood by while she was in sort of self-destruct mode so often, you know. And yes, of course, it was this sense of regret that he and I both shared.
There is so much more to that conversation between writer Anthony Penrose and Sarah Kanofsky, and you'll find links to it online at abc.net.au/rn. Just go to the Books Plus page. While you're there, listen again to Sarah's interview with William Boyd. Lee Miller's career was one of the inspirations for his novel, Sweet Caress. Now on Books Plus, here on RN and Radio Australia, a Shakespearean interlude. We'll begin with the original and move on to a book that reworks one of the most difficult plays, or discomforting perhaps. Romeo and Juliet, on the other hand, is tragic, of course, but also referenced and performed again and again. It's also the choice of Bell Shakespeare's new artistic director, Peter Evans, who's taken the reign from John Bell, who retired last year. Here he is with actors Alex Williams and Kelly Pataniti, speaking with Michael Cathcart. They take us straight into the play itself.
We're going to do the famous The Orbaid scene, which is the scene where Romeo and Juliet have spent the night together. They've consummated their marriage, but Romeo needs to leave before the sun comes up in order to not be caught by the guards.
Wilt thou be gone? It is not yet near day. It was the nightingale and not the lark that pierced the fearful hollow of thine ear. Nightly she sings on yon pomegranate tree, believe me, love, it was the nightingale.
It was the lark, the herald of the morn, no nightingale. Look, love, what envious streaks do lace the severing clouds in yonder east. Night's candles are burnt out, and jocund day stands tiptoe upon the misty mountain tops. I must be gone and live or stay and die.
Yon light is not daylight. I know it, It is some meteor that the sun exhaled to be to thee this night a torchbearer and light thee on thy way to Mantua. Therefore stay yet. Thou needst not to be gone.
Let me be ta'en. Let me be put to death. I am content, so wilt thou have it so. I'll say, yon grey is not the morning's eye. 'Tis but the pale reflex of Cynthia's brow, nor that. Is not the lark whose notes do beat the vaulty heaven so high above our heads? I have more care to stay than will to go. Come, death, and welcome. Juliet wills it so. How is it, my soul? Let's talk. It is not day.
Alex Williams and Kelly Pataniti playing Romeo and Juliet, and they're in our Sydney studios with Peter Evans, who's the director of Bell Shakespeare, which is presenting Romeo and Juliet, the first play for the new season. Alex, who do you reckon Romeo is? What does he want?
Well, look, I think everyone who comes to the role plays it a little differently. You know, I think he is lover at the beginning of the play. He's definitely in love with love. He's in love with the pain that comes with that, I suppose. He hasn't really figured out exactly what love is. So I think he's a young man exploring the different facets of love.
I often think that Romeo and Juliet are just so naive, so caught up with the romance of being in love, that they don't really get what's at stake, even when they kill themselves. I don't think they understand that it's for keeps.
I think the beauty of the play is that he sort of does know it's for keeps. And that's why it's so amazing he does the things that he does. I think if you take the fact that he's not in danger away, it's less remarkable that he does what he does. So, yeah, I believe that the danger is definitely present throughout. I think in the balcony scene, the fact that he does know he can be captured by the guards or killed by the Capulets, there has to be prevalent. Otherwise, it takes the pressure out of it.
Mm. Kelly, what about Juliet? How aware is she what kind of risk she's taking?
In the first scene we have of Juliet, we see her basically be set up for a new marriage that she really has little say in. So I think for Juliet, there's so much at stake. There's so much. She wants her freedom. I think she's so in love with this person, and the idea that she can't be with him is just incredible to her. So I do think you're right. I think there's a youthfulness to the characters that they just completely throw themselves into it. And that's what it is to be young, is not to think of the consequences and not to think of everyone that is around you that is affected by the decisions that you are making. But I guess that's the play. They are 13 and they're headstrong and they throw themselves into this love, and that's why it's quite a wonderful gift to play, because you don't really get to do that much in life.
Peter, as I read the play, there is a villain in this story, and that's the nurse.
Oh, wow. Wow. I would take issue with that, Michael. I think the nurse is obviously an enabler, but I think to go to your point about naivety, one has to remember that Shakespeare's source material, particularly the poem by Arthur Brooke, this is a cautionary tale against young people doing what they want. It's really a tale about listening to your parents. And of course, Shakespeare, in his inimitable style, reverses that and ends up backing the kids. And the friar and the nurse are enablers in that. And of course, there are tragic consequences. But in an interesting way, that the play is really a tragedy of mistakes. It's not a kind of classical tragedy in the sense that the characters have an internal flaw or there's an inciting incident. It's a whole series of mistakes that makes it a tragedy. And if there is a villain in it, it is actually the sins of the fathers. I think it's about the feud that's the central pressure point which drives the play in its very condensed form to the death of the young people.
English actors start their training with Shakespeare. They seem to see it as the base, the foundation of what it means to be an actor. But that's not the way acting training works in Australia. Alex and Kelly, how did Shakespeare figure in your own training? Was it an important part of your training, or is it always a little bit odd to try and get that language to sit in your mouth?
It actually was the beginning of my training, I think. I think the first play I ever did was Romeo and Juliet in high school. And then when I went to Whopper, the first thing they do is make you do Shakespeare. We did Hamlet in, I think, 2.5 weeks. It's such a great exercise. I mean, you don't do it to anyone. It's just a classwork. But it's such a great exercise emotionally and technically. It's very difficult and it's very good for actors in training.
For me personally, I did do some Shakespeare when I was younger, but I feel like I'm still learning it all the time. Every time I sort of think I've got a bit of a handle on it, I kind of go straight back down to the bottom of the mountain and go, oh, I actually know there's so much to learn. And even just doing this play alone, I've read so many books that have given me new insight, new ways at looking at it. So it is so technical and it is a beast and a ride, and I hope to continue learning.
Well, Peter, you've got a big responsibility here because you're training actors how to perform Shakespeare. I guess the task, as I see it, is getting actors to find ways to speak poetry, not as if it's conversation, but as if poetry is a form of diction which is unique to theatre and that can live there as though it is a natural form.
Yeah, beautifully put, Michael. That's exactly it. You know, one of the simplest ways, and when I first met John Bell in 1995, I went to a meeting with him to talk about doing some future work, and he was in the boardroom of Bell Shakespeare. I think we were going into Coriolanus, and he was just doing the lines over and over. And over the last 20 years that I've been working with John, that seems to be the thing that sets him apart, is he says the lines over and over until they sit in the mouth. You often hear cyclists and athletes talk about getting runs in the legs or miles in the legs, and I think it's very similar with Shakespeare. And one of the problems we have is we don't do enough of it or consistently enough. And so one of the simplest things that we do is that we do the language over and over and over, and as you say, so then it can sit naturally in the mouth, but not to make it sound naturalistic, because it is poetic form, but to make it sound natural.
Peter Evans, Artistic Director of Bell Shakespeare, with actors Alex Williams and Kelly Pataniti. Their version of Romeo and Juliet begins this week and runs until the end of March, followed by Canberra and Melbourne in April. You can listen to a longer version of that story with more about staging and the theatrical arts online. Romeo and Juliet is a much-loved and oft-performed play. Others have proved harder to translate. For Michael Cathcart, the odd plot and anti-Semitism of The Merchant of Venice has always made it a difficult play. Moneylenders and pounds of flesh, vengeance and bad behaviour. But that is the play Howard Jacobson has chosen to rework as a novel, as part of a series in which modern novelists retell Shakespeare, a series commissioned by Hogarth to coincide with the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death. Jeanette Winterson has already done The Winter's Tale. Jacobson's version is called My Name is Shylock, but he begins with the play itself, the unease and oddity of it.
It's a discomforting play. It's particularly a discomforting play for Jews, and anybody with any humanity thinks this is a cruel and in some ways bleak play. And that's what I thought anyway until I came to reread it again for this venture, and suddenly, maybe because it had to feel different this time because I was from the beginning needing to look at it in a different spirit, it just felt entirely different. It didn't stop feeling bleak and it didn't stop feeling puzzling and unsatisfactory in all sorts of ways. But what I hadn't realised before was how good the Shylock figure is, how, you know, marvellously present he is, how various he is, why there is no reason to play him as a hunchbacked elderly Jew, particularly elderly. Where does the elderly come from? I mean, that's just an assumption that if he lends money, he must be an old Jew. I've seen him played recently in the Venice ghetto by a young actor, a young non-Jewish, I think he was a Turkish actor, young, full of juice, full of wit, sprightly, and it was fantastic. The whole play looked different. He teased Antonio, he made Bassanio look a clown, he made them all look clowns, actually, which was another reason for them not to like him. But suddenly, seeing different versions and reading it differently, I thought, no, this is still a problematic play, but there ain't no problem around Shylock. Shylock is powerfully felt and powerfully written. He's got the best lines.
So what you've done in the novel is not just sort of update the play in a clever and witty way. You've actually investigated the character of Shylock, but we can also recognise that the story is unfolding in a sort of modern counterpart. So in the opening scene, we have this man, Simon, is it Strulovich? Is that how
Strulovich.
Strulovich, okay. Strulovich, yeah. Who's a wealthy philanthropist with, quote, a distinguished collection of 12th century Anglo-Jewish art. And he meets Shylock in a Cheshire graveyard. Just tell us about that encounter. What's happening there?
Well, Strulovich, who originally, when I first started writing, was going to be my modern Shylock, until I realised that there is no modern Shylock, there is no equivalent, there is only Shylock, and I'm going to have Shylock, Shylock himself, not a modern version, Shylock himself. And I thought, okay, so wouldn't it be interesting to have these two Jews from different periods encounter each other and then have things to say about the whole business of Jewishness and being men and also being fathers, because Strulovich has got a daughter who's also going off the rails, as has Shylock with Jessica. I thought that would be very interesting for them to talk about daughters. And also, they don't have wives. We learn in a very moving, brief period in the play that Shylock no longer has a wife, but he mentions her by name once, Leia. And for some reason, I saw Shylock in a cemetery talking to his wife, Leia. I don't know why I saw that. It just popped into my head. And Strulovich, too, his wife is not dead, but not available to him. She's had a stroke. So they're both lonely men, both, to all intents and purposes, widowers, and both having trouble, as widowers do if they have daughters, bringing up those daughters. So that the idea of having them both in a site of mourning at the very beginning, Strulovich has gone there to lay a stone on his mother's grave. The Jews don't lay flowers, we lay stones. And they encounter each other there. And I thought the fun would be to have Strulevich just know who it was. Just immediately, he hears Shylock talking to Leia in the grave. In fact, he's reading to Leia. In fact, he's reading Philip Roth to Leia in the grave, because she has a sense of humour and would be amused. And Strulevich, you know, there's no question, the reader just has to buy this. He knows who it is. He's well-read. He's a student of Shakespeare as well as a collector of art. And that's Shylock. And he's barely even surprised. He sort of says, well, of course, Shylock is here. When isn't Shylock here?
Yes, in a funny way, Shylock's a kind of foundation Jew. He's the kind of original Jew. If you're thinking in literary terms, he's the Jew we know, I don't know, who kind of sets the story in motion, I suppose. And he's, in many ways, he's both present and not present in the reality of the other people around him. It's as if he's kind of talking into Strulevich's ear.
Yes, and I didn't want to make him a ghost, and I didn't want to make him a spirit, but you could if you're dealing with Shakespeare. Shakespeare doesn't mind that. I thought, you know, let's just ask no questions. He has to be made real. You have to feel his presence. You have to see how he's dressed, and he's dressed very smartly, wears a fedora. I think I say at one point he could be mistaken for a godfather, strong-looking, powerful man with lots of thoughts and lots of anger, of course. I mean, he's carrying the burden of being exactly as you've described it, the foundation Jew. This is the picture of the Jew which many cultures base their knowledge of Jews on, many cultures who've never met a Jew, as indeed Shakespeare might not ever have met a Jew, because to all intents and purposes, there weren't any in Elizabethan England. So that raises the very interesting question. Why is there so much interest in Jews? Why were the Elizabethans, who weren't living with them, for whom Jews were not a day-to-day problem or a day-to-day pleasure, as I'd prefer to think of it, they just didn't know them. So why that pressing concern? And that's in ways that, you know, hard to describe here. Those are the sorts of issues that get talked about in the novel.
Well, presumably one of the reasons that the Elizabethans are so obsessed with Judaism is that they're obsessed also with Christianity and various types of Christianity. Yeah. People have, you know, been burned at the stake for subscribing to the wrong kind of Christianity. And before Christianity, there comes Judaism, and the whole story of Christ and the death of Christ requires you to have a position on the Jews and who they were and what Jesus' relationship was to Judaism, because he himself was a Jew, which is an awkward thing for Christians to face.
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree more. And that's, you know, wherever Christians get together to talk about Christianity, the question of the Jews arises. You know, how do we account as Christians for the fact that we were once Jewish? How do we account for the fact that a faith that we've been brought up to mistrust and even despise, certainly disdain, is our founding faith? This is a problem and has always been a problem for Christians. And it's a dramatized problem in this play.
So in this modern morphing, the Antonio figure, the original Merchant of Venice, has become, I'm sorry to laugh, Danton, who's a very suave gent. Tell us about him.
Danton, yes. Well, he's also he's an aesthete. He collects things. He collects art, just as Strulevich collects art. So there's a battle between them about what kind of art they collect. The art that Danton collects is all very fine, very, very refined. He lives almost in a kind of mock medieval house in this part of Cheshire where I've set the action, the equivalent of Portia's Belmont, you know, that utopia where people live beautifully. So he encapsulates the Portia ideal of living beautifully. And of course, Antonio himself, we take it that he is in love with Bassanio, and it's in the play, and it's a love that will never be requited. So he's something of a self-sacrificial, not to say masochistic, figure. So I enjoyed writing, not without some scorn, I have to admit, writing about his his masochism and his antagonism to Shylock. I mean, all these figures are in the play. It's perfectly clear to me. I think Shakespeare hates this bunch. I think really Shakespeare hates them. Portia and Anto, with different degrees of hate, but I think he has real loathing for them, but doesn't have his usual kind of fun with them. I think it's a bit muted for Shakespeare. So I've demuted it. I've thought I will continue his fun and have it more loudly and have it more, you know, scurrilously. And that was part of the joy of it for me. So to make fun of these people, partly because, or if you like, largely because of their anti-Semitism. They're all, let's not forget, every one of them calls Shylock Jew. Even Portia, who makes that beautiful speech, a famously beautiful speech about mercy, which speech, it seems to me, never really proceeds from her. I think Shakespeare's tacked it on. It's Shakespeare's beautiful speech, and he just gives it to Portia because she's there. But she, too, turns her mercy into something much crueler when the Jew is the object. They all hate Jews, and Anton, in his own way, hates Jews. And it's a kind of comic look, really, at the different ways in which they hate Jews, and Anton's is a very refined, aesthetic way of finding Jews distasteful, really.
When in the play, Shylock gives his famous speech, you know, "Do I not bleed?" in which he says, "I'm a human like you, I suffer like you." That's then the key to Shakespeare's own orientation, is it? It's that which sets the moral compass of the play.
I think it is, but I think it's something else too. I think there's a little moment in the play, which is the most wonderful moment in the play, in which when he discovers that Jessica's run off, Jessica has run off with a ne'er-do-well, another of these Venetian ne'er-do-wells. She steals his money, and she also steals a ring, which ring was given to him by Leia, his wife, Jessica's mother. She would have known, you know, the provenance and the sentimental importance of that ring. When Shylock hears about it, he says, and also he's heard that she's run away, run to Genoa, and pawned the ring for a monkey, for God's sake. And he says, "Thou torturest me, Tubal, that was my turquoise. I had it of Leia when I was a bachelor. I would not have given it for a wilderness of monkeys." And that, for me, is the moment that humanizes Shylock in a way that nobody else in a play is humanized. They make speeches about love. They swap rings. Rings are quite important in this play. They swap rings and then have silly arguments about where's the ring gone and the rest of it. They make endless protestations of love. But in Shylock, you hear a devotion and a melancholy and a sadness that you don't hear anybody else. So it's not just "Hasn't a Jew Eyes," the great speech, and it's a wonderful speech, and it's a strange, comic, and also menacing speech, but it's in those other little touches that we just get the sense of the depth of Shylock's feelings.
Howard, I know the listener is dying to hear what you've made of all this. Perhaps we could have a reading. So there's a scene I'd love you to share with us, which is where Strulevich is talking about his idea to set up an art gallery. Perhaps you could just talk us into this and then read the passage.
Yes, he wants to set up an art gallery of Northern Jewish art in his parents' name. And this is where he encounters, for the first time, Danton, who is opposed to this. Danton is opposed to it on all sorts of grounds, but Strulevich has not a doubt in his mind that the real reason he's opposed to it is because it's Jewish art. Strulevich reminded, that Danton is in a position of power here because he is a sort of advisor on art matters to the local council. Strulevich reminded council officers that the works on display would cost the local ratepayers nothing, that they were a gift from him to them, and that, furthermore, there was no similarity from a cultural or educative point of view between an art gallery and a chamber of horrors. Danton has said, "We might as well have a chamber of horror." Interesting. Danton wondered from whose cultural point of view Mr. Strulevich was speaking. He could, to be frank about it, imagine many who lived in the Golden Triangle finding more to entertain and instruct them in such a venue as he had humorously conjured out of the air than in that presented with so much heat, aforethought, and condescension by the applicant. What evidence indeed was there that there'd be any interest at all in a gallery of Jewish art, British or otherwise, most of which, as he understood the matter, was urban and avant-garde in spirit, in a rural area of outstanding natural beauty with its long history of quiet church-going. He wasn't arguing against the existence of such art. He was something of an avant-gardist himself. Nor was he averse, in principle, to such a venture as Mr. Strulevich proposed. He didn't doubt that in a more culturally apt place, by which Strulevich took him to mean Golders Green or the Negev, it would be welcomed. But why in the name of God a Morris and Leah Strulevich gallery of Jewish art here? Strulevich, who didn't like the way Danton enunciated his parents' names, saw his proposal turn putrid. It hung in the air of the council chamber like a malign presence. As Danton talked, it even took a form, an incubus that would disturb the quiet of the Golden Triangle by day and the sleep of its inhabitants by night. Strulevich could feel its touch, smell it, taste it. He wished he could withdraw all memory of it in order to spare his parents' very name the stench of alien malevolence with which they were now associated. But there was no reversing the ancient imputation of interlopery that Danton had with such expertness laid upon them. Morris and Leah Strulevich. Why, even he, the son, was ready to run from such an incantation of evil. Morris and Leah Strulevich stand on the highest point of Alderley Edge under a full moon and say the names three times, and hell itself would open. As happens when you make an enemy of someone you have never previously met, though you are neighbours, Strulevich now began to run into Danton everywhere, in restaurants in the Golden Triangle, at charitable dinners, at parties thrown by wealthy art collectors, at a concert in the Bridgewater Hall in Manchester, even at a Society of Watercolourists reception in London. Am I imagining him, Strulevich wondered? Am I conjuring him out of the hatred we bear each other? He was careful never to meet his eyes and felt confident that Danton was no more eager to meet his. What's happening to me, Strulevich wondered? Was he turning into one of those Jews who saw insults to his Jewishness everywhere? God forbid. Such a person only insulted himself. Weren't there plenty of non-Jews he didn't like? I will not behave like this, he promised himself. I will not allow myself to feel slighted by the rustlings of a mouse.
Yeah, that's a powerful piece of writing, that. How did that feel in your mouth? Did you enjoy reading that, or do you feel a kind of... Do you feel your own Jewishness being challenged by it in some way?
I've never read that before, I have to say. You have a first, Michael. I've never read it aloud, that is, and I've not looked at it for a long time. I've read, you know, so far I've read from other parts of the novel, but not that. I'm a little taken aback by how angry it is, by how enraged it is, and how angry I must have been when I wrote it. But, I mean, I'm the kind of writer that turns anger into a kind of zest. I like it. I like being in that mood. But it is reminding me, as I've been talking about the novel, I'd forgotten how heated it is and how I like talking about my comedy and, you know, is it funny, is it not, the rest of it. But I'd forgotten how much of the anger is driven by passion in this book. And I'm very grateful to you to be reminded of it. Yes, that's a long way of saying yes, I've just enjoyed reading that passage very much.
Howard Jacobson's novel, My Name is Shylock, is published by Hogarth. And you can listen to a longer version of that interview too, through a link online. I'm Kate Evans, and you're listening to Books Plus on RN, Radio Australia, and on your pod thingy.
Inside a broken clock, splashing the wine with all the rain dogs. Taxi, we'd rather walk, huddle a doorway with the rain dogs.
Crime writer Adrian McKinty has been naming the books in his Sean Duffy series of novels after Tom Waits songs. The latest is Rain Dogs. McKinty is an Irishman who lives in Melbourne, but when I spoke to him earlier this week, he was in New York. Adrian McKinty, welcome again to RN.
It's great to be back.
Now, you're an Irishman who lives in Melbourne, but I'm speaking to you now from New York. How are you finding New York as a place to write?
Well, New York is actually very interesting. Today, it's been snowing all day, and that's sort of my first experience of snow in about 10 years, really. And I've just been sitting, looking out the window, looking at the snow, and I thought, well, this is going to be so great to write in because I can get very cozy. I can wrap a blanket around me. I can get the old laptop on the lap, and I can just look out the window and write with this really atmospheric world going on. But in fact, it hasn't worked out at all, really, because I've just become too entranced and fascinated by the spectacle of snow falling that I haven't really been doing anything. And then I have the kids with me, and they wanted to go out and play in the snow because they're more or less Aussie kids. They were both born in America, but they've grown up in Melbourne. And so we've been out playing in the freezing cold snow all day. So if you were to ask me today how the weather and the landscape and the environ has influenced my writing, I'd say for the negative.
But I know that recently you attempted a writer's retreat in the quiet and in the wilderness, not being in a city. What happened? Did that work for you?
Oh, yeah. This was last summer. I had a book deadline looming. And if you're a writer, it's a pretty easy lifestyle, except when it comes around deadline times. And there are those writers who, like those horrible kids in class, used to get their homework finished 2 days early or get their project into their professor 3 days before it was due. And I was one of those guys knocking on the professor's door at 5 p.m. on the Friday saying, please, please, I'm only a minute late. Can you accept this? And I also have that problem with deadlines. And I had a book that was due last year. And there's a great phrase that Douglas Adams, the writer, said, you know, he loves deadlines. He loves the great whooshing noise they make as they go by. Douglas Adams, he could basically do no wrong for his publishers, whereas my publishers keep me in a tighter leash. And so I had a book due and it was overdue. And I decided that I wasn't to blame for my poor time management. It was the kids and the misses and all the distractions of living in St. Kilda. And so I took a little cabin in the forest south of Dover, Tasmania. And I thought, this will be fantastic. I'll go to the forest and I'll have no distractions and it'll be nothing to do. And I'll just get my laptop. And I make sure that it had a power cable. And that was all it really had, really. Just a little bit of electricity and one outlet. I'll plug in the laptop and get my work done. And then when I went down there, I forgot the fact, this was last August. And I forgot somehow that Tasmania is actually very cold in July and August. And when I got down to this little cabin, it was this plywood little affair right in the forest, and it was absolutely freezing. And I was so cold, I was sitting over the laptop, and my whole body was shaking, and I was shivering, and I had all the blankets wrapped around me, and it still wasn't doing any good. And then it was so cold that night, and there was no heater in the place, that I actually turned the, don't do this at home, folks, I turned the gas rings of the cooker on and lit them and tried to stay warm with the gas rings. And then I feared asphyxiation the whole night and didn't get a wink of sleep. And then this went on for 3 days. And at the end of these 3 days in the forest, and I got nothing done, and I was tired and hungry and feeling really sorry for myself, and I just came home with my tail between my legs, and my family embraced me in this. And then I eventually got the work done the way professionals get their work done, which is you get up early in the morning, you make yourself a cup of coffee, and you just write and get it all done before breakfast. And so my cabin in the woods experience was a complete disaster. But getting up early and getting the work done is the way to go.
Well, you have been producing, and so let's turn to your latest book, Rain Dogs. I can't help but comment, though, that this is the fifth Sean Duffy novel in a trilogy. Now, that doesn't quite add up, does it?
No, it doesn't add up at all. It makes no sense. To quote from Douglas Adams again, it's the fifth book in the increasingly inaccurate named Sean Duffy trilogy. And I think the reason why it's the fifth book is because all my previous books in series had been a more or less a disaster in terms of sales. And this one actually has sold, and people have actually wanted to buy it. So at the end of the third book, I had planned to kill Sean Duffy. I had, spoiler alert, what I thought was the perfect ending to the third book. The Grand Hotel in Brighton is blown up, and it's the real event. Mrs. Thatcher was in the Grand Hotel, and I thought, wouldn't it be poetic and wonderful and ironic for Duffy to die saving Mrs. Thatcher's life? Because he hates Thatcher. And I thought, that would be a fantastic way to end the book. So that's how I ended the book. And my editor talked me down from that ledge. And she said, you know, don't kill him. Because what if people actually like these books, Adrian, you know, actually start buying these? You don't want to kill him at the end. So I thought, all right. But if I ever write another one, I'm definitely killing him in the fourth book. So I wrote this fourth book where it ends with, this is also a real life incident, where basically MI5 put all their experts on Northern Ireland and the IRA into a helicopter, a big Chinook helicopter, and they flew that helicopter into a mountain in Scotland. And it was real tragedy, and they killed everyone. So all their, basically their top intel guys and women on Northern Ireland and the IRA were all killed in this tragic incident. And I thought, well, this is the way to kill Duffy. I'll put him on that helicopter and he can die tragically on the mountain in the western part of Scotland. So again, I wrote that as the ending of the fourth book and sent it off to my editor, and she read the book and again was horrified and said, Adrian, I like the book, but you can't kill Duffy. You know, you can't kill him in this helicopter. And so now I've stopped killing him at the end of these novels because I know that she'll just talk me out of it if I keep doing it. But I write them all very much as a standalone. if the series does end with book five, I'll be happy to end it here.
So remind us who Sean Duffy is. I mean, he's a Catholic police officer in an overwhelmingly Protestant police force during the Troubles. But is it the big picture that consumes him, or everyday crime and bad behaviour?
Well, exactly, that's it. The central sort of conceit is that he's a Catholic policeman in a more or less Protestant police station in Northern Ireland. And everywhere else in the world, that's so what? He's a Catholic, they're Protestant, that doesn't mean anything. But in Northern Ireland, that means everything. I mean, there it's the sectarian divide, or as Freud called it, the narcissism of the small differences, you know, all these little differences between Protestants and Catholics. And the police force back then was about 85% Protestant and about 15% Catholic. So he's this Catholic guy in this Protestant police station living also in a Protestant housing estate. And for me, all those sort of delicious little fracture lines, which again, don't mean anything to anybody outside Northern Ireland, but mean a lot here. I mean, he's a middle-class boy. They're all working class. He's slightly better educated. They haven't been to uni. He has. He's from a different part of Ireland. He's from Derry. They're all from Belfast. And again, the big difference is that he's a Catholic and they're Protestant. And it's during the Troubles, so it's the 1980s. So it's basically chaos is erupting all around them all the time. But these ordinary policemen are trying to solve ordinary crimes within the chaos. I mean, I read a book recently, and it was this fascinating idea of a comet is heading towards the Earth, and they're about to wipe out the entire planet. But, you know, what do the policemen do? They're still trying to solve these little crimes, even though the end of the world is nigh. And even though there's this chaos on the streets around them, they're still trying to solve the ordinary murders and kidnappings and bank robberies that take place.
Or the not-so-ordinary murders. Because I know that you like referencing crime writing tropes and conventions. And in the novel before this, there was a closed room murder. So you can't have a second one, can you?
Yeah, it's always been my dream to write a locked room mystery. I loved those when I was a kid. I must have read about 100 of them. And it was always my dream to have a modern locked room mystery within a noir thriller. And I did it in the third book of the Duffy series. And I thought, well, I'll never do that again. I've shot my bolt. And then I came up with this very, what I think is a very sneaky idea for having another one, and how impossible that would be. The same policeman could never in a million years have a murder like that once in his career. And for it to happen twice is just ridiculous. It's statistically impossible. He actually does the math himself. He figures it out and proves it's statistically impossible. And so something very odd is going on. There's actually a locked castle mystery. One of the things about Carrickfergus, where Duffy lives, is that there's this great big 800-year-old castle, which I've never referred to in any of the previous four books, partly because it's so obvious and it's just this big hunk of rock sitting there that everybody just sort of ignores. And I thought, well, there we go. It's four books and no one's ever been inside this enormous castle, this 800-year-old castle. I've got to have, in this fifth book, Duffy go into the castle. And then I thought about it a bit and I thought, well, what if I had a murder in the castle? And then I thought about it a bit more and I thought, well, what if I have a murder in the castle and it's got these big 60-foot walls and it's got a 2-ton portcullis gate which you can't get through, and we have no idea how the murderer got in to commit the murderer or how the murderer could possibly have got out from this murder scene. And so I thought, well, that's just too delicious. I've got to write this.
So there is that playful element, but then there's also some terribly serious elements that you layer on top of that. So there's also political conspiracy and institutional abuse. So how much were you influenced by recent inquiries in Britain, things like the Jimmy Savile case? How important was it to put those types of things into, you know, these terribly entertaining crime novels?
Well, I mean, I felt it was tremendously important. I think all these things that have come out in the last 2 or 3 years that basically told us that everything in the 1980s that we believed or were told by the press and the media, it was all a lie. All the people that we were told were public enemy number one, like Johnny Rotten and Morrissey and all those people who are always in the front page of the Daily Mail. These people will corrupt your children, you know, the Sex Pistols and the Smiths. They're the terrible mortal enemies. And they've both become respected writers and quite respectable people, though Johnny Rotten would hate for people to say that he's respectable now, but he, you know, he is. Whereas the people we were held up as the icons of that era, the people we were supposed to like, the BBC One official icons of that area, Jimmy Savile and Rolf Harris. And it turned out these guys were monsters and getting away with it because they were institutionally approved of. I mean, Jimmy Savile's case is extraordinary. I read that report that the Metropolitan Police produced on what he was able to get away with. I mean, he was an unofficial godfather to Princes William and Harry. You know, he was made a papal knight by Pope John Paul II. He was actually knighted by Mrs. Thatcher. And so he was made a knight of the realm. And he had extraordinary access for five Christmases in a row. He spent it with the Prime Minister and her family at Chequers, which is the Prime Minister's country estate. And I just thought, this is extraordinary. And the level of the cover-up and the level of corruption and the level of, it has to be said, police incompetence across about four or five police forces where there was just laziness and incompetence. And I thought, oh, Duffy has to run into something like this and then get really, really angry about it.
So were you angry as you were writing about that?
I actually was quite angry. The Metropolitan Police produced this report called Giving the Victims a Voice about Jimmy Savile in particular. And when you read the number of victims and the number of times that they actually were so brave and went to the police and said, look, this guy is a monster. And then the police and every police force in the British Isles, in, you know, Metropolitan Police, West Yorkshire Police, Northern Irish Police, Republic of Ireland Police, Scottish Police, and they all did nothing. And that is extraordinary. And anybody who's not pissed off about this, I just don't understand it.
So how then do you write a novel that's, you know, it's recent history, but it's set in another period? And do you want to then add compassion, add a voice who listens? Do you make Sean Duffy somebody who's not of his time?
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? You can't have someone have the information that they wouldn't have gotten until 2013. I think Savile dies in 2013. And so you have to have, it's like the iceberg. You have to have a little bit poking through the surface and hints of a wider conspiracy and hints of what was really going on. But you can't have this worldly wise person in 1987 or 1988 who can see the way things really are. So that is the tension within the writing of this character. You know, he's a person of his time and is constricted by his time. But you want to give enough hints of what's really going on so that he can get a sense of the wider conspiracy and the wider disaster, really, and so can the reader.
Adrian McKinty, congratulations on Rain Dogs. Thanks for speaking to us. Will there be another Sean Duffy, or are you not sure?
I'm not sure. I don't have a contract and I don't have a deadline, which is a good thing, but I maybe need both of those things to get my bottom kicked and get writing, so we'll see.
Because life has changed for Sean Duffy by the end of the novel, but we can't quite talk about that, can we?
Yeah, I know. I certainly didn't want to write another one of these unless there was major growth for the character. And we've all read those series books where they essentially, the author does a reset button and everything just happens all over again. And I thought, well, I hate those books where they do that. I like it where the character grows and changes and their story arcs a little bit. And I thought, if I'm going to write this one and I'm not going to kill him, I'm going to have big changes for the character throughout the novel and certainly at the end.
Adrian, thank you again.
Thank you very much, Kate.
Adrian McKinty's Rain Dogs is published by Serpent's Tale. McKinty also wrote a very funny account of his failed attempt at writerly solitude in that remote cottage in the woods. You'll find a link to it on the Books Plus website at abc.net.au/rn. While you're there, look around for other books you might have missed. But never fear, there are more books next week, including Jacqueline Moriarty's A Tangle of Gold. Colours are solid and dangerous in the world she's created, so watch out. I'm Kate Evans. Thanks, as always, to Sue Clark. See you at the bookshelf next week. And do stay with RN until we do.